Good evening, everyone. My name is Ingrid Lunt, and I'm the acting principal here at Green Templeton College, and want to welcome you very warmly indeed to the Cochrane Lecture. This is a very special event in our Green Templeton College calendar of lectures, and we always manage to attract an absolutely terrific speaker, and I know that tonight is no exception. I'm not going to delay you anymore, and I'm going to hand over to Richard Peto, who will talk a little bit about the Cochrane Lecture. Richard.
Actually, I'll talk a little bit about Archie Cochrane. Cochrane Lectures came to be because Archie Cochrane wanted to leave his money to me and Richard Doll to do something or other in tropical medicine instead of always studying the diseases of the rich. And he actually didn't write his will very carefully, so he finished up leaving the money to Green College instead, with no specification it was anything to do with me and Richard. So anyway, he said that he'd done it, but when he died and his will was read out, it was left. So Green College accepted it very gratefully and spent it on students, which is a very reasonable thing to do. But in the process, established the Cochrane Lecture. Now, the money's entirely gone, and Green College is left with the liability of doing the Cochrane Lecture every year. So that's how the Cochrane Lectures got established. That's about 20 or 25 or more years ago now. Archie was he was a lovely guy. He'd had the distinction of having done his first clinical trial while in a German prison camp in Greece in the middle of the Greek famine. And so, you know, if you're in the middle of a famine anyway, then a German prison camp isn't a very good place to be. And so the prisoners were running out of food and they were all swelling up, you know, getting these pitting edema and so on. And so Archie spoke perfect German, and the German and the camp doctor got together as doctors and decided they were going to do a trial where they'd boil up some yeast, you know, get some yeast and feed men, you know, feed a group of men some of this yeast, because they thought it was going to give them vitamins. You know, vitamins had only just been invented and they were very fashionable. And so they gave them, and, you know, within not very long, the men started pissing and pissing just at every 5 minutes, and the edema just disappeared in the ones that they'd given this yeast brew to. And so, you know, they went off and demanded to the camp commandant that the camp should be closed or the rations improved. Anyway, they got transported to Germany instead, which wasn't a very good place to be. And in fact, he said he misunderstood his first trial, because in fact he decided it was vitamins, but it was probably just that there was some protein in the yeast and there was actually zero protein in the diet otherwise. But anyway, what really changed his mind about statistics was, you know, he'd studied medicine in Gower Street the way people do, and you know, did all the things that you're supposed to do when people have got TB, like collapsing their lungs and so on. And there he was in a prison camp with all these people speaking all kinds of different languages that he was supposed to look after. He couldn't speak Russian to them or this, that, and the other thing, but he could comfort them when they were feeling, when they were dying and things like that. But none of the things that he could do, could he do anymore. It seemed to him that the proportion that got better was roughly the same as he remembered from Gower Street, and so it made him wonder whether any of it was, any of the things were any use at all. And so he came back and got quite depressed in the 1940s at the inability of doctors ever to know anything. And then randomised evidence turned up, you know, and he thought that Bradford Hill was, I don't know, some kind of Latter-day Saint, because he'd actually randomised streptomycin versus no streptomycin, and, you know, there was a clear difference, and it couldn't be anything but cause and effect, because they'd been separated by randomisation. And so he became a devotee of randomised evidence and an epidemiologist and so on. And anyway, having come from a rich family, he was still rich when he died, and so that's why we're all here now. But he'd actually become quite obscure at the end. He's world famous now because the Cochrane collaboration has been so wonderfully successful, and Ian Chalmers named it after him, which is very nice. But, you know, by the time he died, he'd actually sunk into obscurity. And in fact, at the cremation, Richard Doll and I were the only epidemiologists there. Well, the only living epidemiologists, anyway. And so, well, God, I actually got Nick White to laugh. Right, in that case, from now on, you've got to introduce Nick White. Welcome to the Cochrane Lecture.
Thanks, Richard. My name's Jeremy Farrer. One of Nick's protégés, I would glad to say, over the last, 25 years, and a great privilege and pleasure to introduce. It's not a pleasure and a privilege to receive an email from Richard Peto, though, which says, you've got to be there. I'd like a stimulating intro, and I'll read this out, it was underlined, a stimulating intro by you, preferably with some content rather than just rubbish ceremony.
A lovely way with words.
Tim, come and have a seat. So if anybody knows what that means, let me know. Anyway, it's a particular also because Nick has been the Cochrane has been, Cochrane Collaboration has been a very, very close to Nick's heart for many, many years, and he's found it brilliant in all sorts of ways. So it's very interesting to, it'll be very interesting to hear what he says in the context of Cochrane. Nick is a brilliant scientist, for those of you who don't know him, brilliant clinician. He's going to talk about malaria tonight, I guess, again. But actually, Nick's contribution in Southeast Asia, where I was also based for the last 18 years or so, actually, Nick's brain and fingers are in almost every good stuff that's come out of Southeast Asia research programs over the last 20 years. So although you talk about malaria tonight, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about typhoid or tetanus or dengue, melioid or emerging infections, Japanese encephalitis, Nick's fingers are all over those and have been throughout the last 20 years. And I think one of the real things that I judge what somebody's contribution, of course, a few people changed the world, Nick has changed the world, but I think the real contribution, and I think this is a very important part of Oxford, and Nick is very much in this tradition, of people that not only made a massive contribution, and Richard Doll is one, dare I say it, Richard Peter might be another, people who not only made brilliant contributions, changed the world, but also through their mentorship, generosity of spirit, and enjoyment of the success of others, helped others in the generations that followed them also do a small contribution to medicine and, in Nick's case, global health. And I think, actually, increasingly, that's how we should judge people's contribution. And I think Nick stands up there with the very best, the Wetherills, the Dolls, the Pitos of this world. And he has, through his own inherent stubbornness, been on the right side of all of the big arguments over the last 20 to 30 years, and that is a remarkable contribution. His generosity of spirit is, I think, unparalleled, and it comes with humility and a degree of humanity, and also ensuring that fun is at the heart of almost everything you do. He's an accomplished, apparently accomplished cricketer. I've never actually seen him play, but he tells me he's a very accomplished cricketer, musician, and many other things. And I say, he has a love of Cochrane. He's impressed with the Cochrane reviews of malaria treatment over the last few years, and has never once said a bad word about it. Also highlight the contribution of his better half, Jum, who's here, without whom I don't think he would have made quite the same contribution over the years, and her role in keeping him, I'd like to say sane, but I don't think that's been Jum's real contribution, is also should be acknowledged. So, Nick, the floor is yours. It's very good of you to put a suit and tie on. And I look forward to hearing all good things. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very over-generous introductions. Yes, it is about malaria. So I was told by Richard, again, to give this talk on malaria control, past, present and future. As you'll see from my haircut, past is my speciality, the future may not be. So I'll spend a lot of it on the past in the hope we can learn some lessons from the past. Just a brief contemporary update. This is the WHO's version of the truth. 2014 World Malaria Report. About 200 million cases of malaria and over 500,000 deaths. So this is the world's most important parasitic disease. Well, if you're human, that is. And it remains a major threat to the health and welfare of people living in tropical countries. But it's been, we've had some improvement in recent years, and I guess the real interest is to discuss whether that improvement is going to be sustained. We estimate, or they estimate, that about 3.3 million deaths have been averted since the beginning of the millennium. What about the past? Well, we think of malaria as a tropical disease, but it wasn't. It was a global disease. This is Dürer pointing to his enlarged spleen. In fact, malaria was everywhere, and it's notable that all these prosperous areas of the world were once malarious, and perhaps nowhere more evident than in the United States, where, particularly in the southern United States, malaria was rampant. Malaria interfered with the building of the Erie Canal, of the Ottawa Canal in Canada. I'll show you in a minute the Panama Canal. It was really bad in the southern United States, particularly in the Tennessee Valley here. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control were formed specifically to fight malaria. That was their primary target. So during the 20s and 30s, there was remarkable progress in the United States in malaria control, which was sustained during the Second World War, actually, until elimination from the country shortly afterwards. Malaria still resurges occasionally. It's imported from Central America, and there are small outbreaks, but the United States is now free of malaria. Malaria was rampant throughout southern Europe, particularly in Portugal, Spain, Greece, and Italy. This is a dwelling in the Roman Campania in the 1920s. It was said if you stopped one night in the Roman Campania, you would get malaria, which suggests what we in malaria we call this the entomological inoculation rate. That's the rate at which you get bitten by a mosquito carrying malaria, and that would be comparable with some of the highest transmission areas of Africa. So malaria was a global disease. It even occurred around the Arctic Circle. There was a particularly bad outbreak of falciparum malaria in Archangel in the 1920s, and Finnish troops fighting the Russians in the Second World War had vivax malaria. So was a disease of all the world now a tropical disease? Now, what about England? Well, we had malaria all up the eastern seaboard. Hereward the Wake's forces were said to have been diminished by malaria. There's even a little bit up about in Liverpool. There were particular foci on the east coast. The Isle of Sheppey was said to be a malarious. There's some seats here. Malaria Island. This is the more. These are the good old days of epidemiology. Richard will remember these, where it wasn't necessary to be too precise about what the vertical axis contained. Just suffice to say, there were hundreds, and they got less and less and less and less, and as you can see, almost eliminated. And then this resurgence just after the First World War, when soldiers brought back malaria from the Balkans. For the following year, this was vivax malaria, but there are different malarias. Falciparum is the one that accounts for most of the deaths, but the one that was prevalent throughout Europe and the northern parts of North America was another one called vivax malaria. This relates to the geography, not the individual, and you can see that malaria was mainly associated with marsh areas. Oliver Cromwell is said to have died from malaria, although I'm afraid it's more likely to have been a renal stone. Nobody knew what it was caused by, but they did know that there was a potential treatment, and that was the bark, the Jesuit's bark, the bark of a tree that named erroneously, as it turned out, by Linnaeus after the Countess of Cinchon, so the cinchona tree, the cinchona bark, the drug, main drug, quinine. In fact, there are four alkaloids, quinine and quinidine, cinchonine and cinchonidine. And actually, very interestingly, when you work out the doses that people used, and I know this is about control, but I am very interested in the therapeutics, the doses that were recommended in the Schedula Romana from the Ospedale Spiritus Santo in Rome and employed by people like Willis and Sydenham were very, very similar to the doses we use today. Note, this is probably the first reference to Little Britain here. And there's another, from a medical perspective, an interesting aspect, because the physicians were always at war with the apothecaries, and the apothecaries had the lead here. And the foremost individual was Sir Robert Talbot, or sometimes written as Talbot, who was a humble individual. He said that he was the best person in the world to treat agues, and he managed to convince not only the King of England, but also Louis XIV, and he cured the son of the Sun King, the Dauphin, from ague, and was duly rewarded by an enormous amount of money and knighthood by Charles. And so This remedy became known as the English remedy, or Talbot's wonderful secret. But of course, no one, the germ theory was a couple of centuries ahead, and nobody really could figure out why sometimes it seemed to work and sometimes it didn't work. And Torti was the first one to say, well, actually, there are diseases which are sensitive, and he drew this fever tree of sensitive to the bark and those which are not. All very well, but this bark was precious and unaffordable, and so very few people had access to it. Pelletier and Caventou, a statue to them in Paris, were identified the structure, but it was never, and still to this day, cost-effective to extract this or to synthesize this de novo. So we still get this drug from the bark of the cinchona tree. There are a few diversions. Homeopathy arose out of observations with quinine. I won't go into that story. This is an even better story. This is William Henry Perkin trying to synthesize quinine in his bedroom or kitchen in the East End of London, made a mistake, made mauve, and thus was born the dye industry, which interestingly comes back because it was the aniline dye industry in the 1920s particularly which morphed into the pharmaceutical industry in Germany, which gave us the synthetic anti-malarial drugs. Let's go back to South America, where many people are trying to find the high-yielding bark that will allow this drug to be used for malaria control, amongst them Henry Wellcome, before he discovered tabloids and became rich and headed a pharmaceutical company. The British felt that they had the best bark, the best seedlings, and planted extensively in Madras. But this individual, Charles Ledger, who was a remarkable explorer, prospector, entrepreneur, discovered a plant high up in the Bolivian Andes, which had the highest yields recorded yet. And he did have a servant, and I kid you not, his name is Manuel. And he asked Manuel, he said, Manuel, these trees, very good. You bring the seeds back. Here's £5. He then went back to the coast and waited and waited and waited. One winter passed, Manuel did not return. A second winter passed, Manuel did not return. He gave up all hope. The third winter, Manuel arrived at his door with a sack of seeds. And the story was that he'd sat in this grove looking at the tree. It must have been a slightly boring occupation as it lasted 2.5 years. The first year there was a bad frost, the flowers died. The second year there was a bad frost, the flowers died. The third year there wasn't a bad frost, there were seeds, and he bought them. And Ledger thought, this is the beginning of my fortune. But the British were very happy with their actually rather inferior plantations in Madras, and so the sad story is that his brother sold the seeds eventually to the Dutch for 20 quid. And within about 20 years, the Dutch had 90% of the global market for quinine because they knew how to do this, and their plantations were in Java, and as we'll see in the Second World War, they were taken over, and that stimulated synthetic anti-malarial drug development. But I think this summarizes the history of the cinchona plantation. But cinchona was very important for the scramble for Africa, and it enabled people to survive, particularly in the heartland of malaria, which is this belt across Africa. The most intense transmission in the world is in this belt, particularly to this day. I mean, transmission, although we've done very well with malaria, transmission intensities here in the countries recently affected by the Ebola epidemic is not much different to that throughout history, and there are very high transmission intensities here too. Because quinine was associated with curing or benefit, it became known as a tonic, and I know that you're all familiar with it as a tonic. It became part of wine and this very effective anti-malarial treatment, which is large quantities of both of these. If you do want to treat malaria, you can do it with Indian tonic water, but you must drink 8 litres 3 times a day. What transformed cinchona, usage of cinchona for control, was price, and it was those plantations in Java and the increased production thereof, which led to a reduction in price and thus an increase in availability. And quinine became actually quite an important part of control of malaria, particularly in Europe. What was malaria? Well, no one knew. And then we have Pasteur and the development of the germ theory, and perhaps the most prominent microbiologist of the time, Robert Koch, who discovered Mycobacterium tuberculosis, and Edwin Klebs, who we named Klebsiella after. They sorted it out. They discovered the bacteria that caused malaria. It was called Bacillus malariae. So people were not very happy when this rather strange-looking gentleman said, no, it's not actually a bacteria, it's a parasite, and I've seen it in my hospital in Constantine in what is now Algeria, in French North Africa. But soon people did agree with Laverin, and very quickly, I think within 10 years, the ability to diagnose malaria spread across the world, and malaria could now be separated from other causes of febrile illness. This is Osler, who is castigating his staff for failing to recognize malaria. It's said that Osler was the first person to introduce a routine blood test in medicine because one of his patients at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland, had died from malaria and had been misdiagnosed as having pneumonia. So it was a parasite. How was it transmitted? Manson had discovered that mosquitoes could transmit filariasis in Amoy in China, and he suggested to this ambitious young Indian army captain at that time, Ronald Ross, that he should look for the mosquitoes as the agent for transmitting malaria. And Ross did indeed find that the dapple-winged mosquito, after a lot of trial and error, mainly error, could transmit malaria, and about the same time the Italians discovered exactly the same thing. Ross got the Nobel Prize, and the Italians didn't, and that's been a source of some discord ever since. What Ross actually discovered or recognised under the microscope were these eggs. These are the eggs of malaria, if you like. They're so-called oocysts lining the midgut of a mosquito, female anopheline mosquito. Ross became obsessed with the idea that mosquito control could eliminate malaria, and he wasn't interested in any other approaches. And his fame spread, and so did his standing. And he was able to persuade the British authorities to undertake a very extensive and somewhat costly experiment in a place called Mianmir, which is near Lahore in Pakistan today, where they tried to control mosquito transmission to see whether it affected malaria, and it didn't work. It didn't work, and Ross blamed his students for this. His two students became two of the most eminent malariologists of the day, so there's a moral in that tale. In Europe, it was Celli, amongst many brilliant Italian malariologists, who really introduced the concept that if you wanted to control malaria, you had to improve public health, and you had to improve the environment. And this combination of improving public health and the environment merged into an idea called bonification, which was one of the few good things that Benito Mussolini did. And Mussolini actually was responsible for a substantial reduction in malaria transmission in Italy. That's about the only good thing he was involved with. The Panama Canal, as you know, de Lesseps had failed in building it, largely because of yellow fever transmitted by the Aedes aegypti mosquito and malaria transmitted by the anopheline mosquito. But the second attempt led by Gorgas, where there was military control of mosquito transmission. Everybody was given quinine. All the dwellings had intact mosquito nets. They weren't more nets, they were more grills. And there was a very, very vigorous attack on breeding sites with use of something called Paris Green and oil. And to all this allowed the successful building of the Panama Canal. So malaria was very much in the forefront of global interest and attention in the first decades of the 20th century, and many of the leading malariologists were rewarded by Nobel Prizes. Ross in 1902. Koch worked a lot, actually, on malaria, although he didn't get his Nobel Prize for that. Golgi didn't get his Nobel Prize for malaria, but was another famous malariologist. Perhaps, and Ehrlich also. Ehrlich, the father of chemotherapy, was the first person to develop a synthetic, any anti-infective drug, and he introduced methylene blue as a treatment for malaria. And it worked a bit. In fact, we're looking at it again now. But Ehrlich didn't get it for malaria. And perhaps the most interesting of all was this gentleman, a humorist, who was a Viennese neuropsychiatrist. Here, after fully informed consent was obtained, infecting a patient with syphilis with malaria. And malaria became the treatment of choice for neurosyphilis. In fact, it worked. It didn't work in everybody, but neurosyphilis was accounting for about 10% of all inmates in mental hospitals or asylum, as they were called at that time. And so it was a huge problem, and there was no treatment for it. And Wagner Jaurig had realized that high fever could kill the spirochetes that caused syphilis. And so he eventually led him to this process called malaria therapy, whereby people were given controlled infections. And about a third of them were cured, about a third benefited, a third didn't. But it was used between about 1920 and 1950 as the primary treatment for neurosyphilis. And as a result of that, malaria became the best studied of all human infections to this day, because man was the experimental animal. Now, I realise I've gone slightly off-piste here, so I better come back to the main target, which is control. And the people in charge of malaria control for the world, except the United States, were the League of Nations. And the League of Nations were very active in encouraging research and implementation of effective measures in Europe. And Europe did very well, but the real push, I think, to elimination in the temperate countries was the Second World War. Now, there's... where is it? There, somewhere there is Java. I can't see from this angle. There's Java. So, with the Japanese empire expanding, the Allies knew Java was going to fall. There was a great big push to try and find alternative drugs for quinine. And perversely, the most effective drug, the drug which was used by both sides in the Second World War, was developed by the Germans in 1932. Chloroquine, which subsequently became the most widely used drug that human beings have ever been exposed to, in that the average person in the tropics had chloroquine in their blood for about 50 years, from about 1950 to 2000. Chloroquine was also developed by the Eberhard Laboratories, Bayer Laboratories, in 1934, but was ignored during the Second World War. But mepocrine was used, and through reciprocal arrangements between Bayer and Winthrop, was used by the Allies. The structure was available to the Allies. So mepocrine became the drug that both sides used, and through research on mepocrine came studies on how to use or improve methods of using anti-malarial drugs to both prevent and treat malaria. Italy, malaria control in Italy, I think, has been one of the best documented histories, and this is a very good book by Frank Snowden. And effectively, you can't put your finger on one single aspect that resulted in the elimination of malaria from Italy. It was really a combination of all these factors. So buoyed with this enthusiasm, these new tools, particularly the new synthetic anti-malarials, and also the discovery that a compound called DDT, which had been known about for a long time but had not been used in insecticide, was in fact a very valuable residual insecticide. So with these two tools, synthetic anti-malarial drug, chloroquine after the Second World War, and DDT, the newfound formed World Health Organization decided to embark on an ambitious project to see whether it would be feasible to eliminate malaria from the world. There's a lot of argument about this. Note the trousers. Was it possible to eliminate malaria from the heartland of malaria in Africa, where the transmission intensities were really high. And there were those who said, no, it's impossible, and there were those who, particularly the mathematical modelling by a very influential British malariologist called MacDonald, he said, yes, it was theoretically possible, and that argument carried the day. So 1955, the World Health Assembly embarked upon eradication. And it's often said that the malaria eradication campaign was successful in eradicating malariologists but failed to eradicate malaria. But it did. It depends whether, you know, it's a glass half full, glass half empty argument. Many people said it was a failure, but actually in many countries there were remarkable reductions in malaria. Sri Lanka is a classic. Sri Lanka was down to approximately one order of magnitude, probably wrong, possibly two, but still a marked reduction in malaria in the mid-60s. And by the early 1970s, there were 2 million cases again, which shows the incredible reproductive capability of malaria if you don't actually get rid of it. But malaria was eliminated from North America, eliminated from, well, almost all of the USSR, eliminated from Europe, and markedly reduced in many tropical countries. So the map really was very different by 1977. Nevertheless, it didn't work, and when campaigns which have been vigorously and enthusiastically prosecuted don't work, it's not really very good to be involved with them in the aftermath. So we now enter an era known euphemistically as containment, when very little was done to control malaria. And malaria took advantage of that. There was the rapid decline in interest in malaria, a decay in the structures that had delivered the malaria attempted malaria eradication campaign, decolonization and war in many areas, and resistance. And it was resistance to the two main tools, resistance to the insecticide DDT and resistance to chloroquine, which were to come after this, after the 1970s, and really caused a resurgence of malaria in the 1980s and 1990s. So this was not a good time to be a person living in a malaria endemic area, because things were going badly wrong. And in particular, the drugs were dying and in some cases dead. I mean, give you an example, Burma, now Myanmar, was using drugs to treat malaria in the beginning of the year, well, about 8 years ago, that were completely ineffective in the 1970s. So for over 25 years, the national policy was drugs that weren't just partially, they were completely ineffective for a major killing disease. Then, so interest declined. There were no wars going on in the middle of the 1960s, but there was certainly a war building up in Southeast Asia in the end of the 1960s, and both sides knew that their forces were going to be adversely affected by malaria. And Ho Chi Minh knew this, and he asked Zhou Enlai for help. And Zhou Enlai, this was just the immediate aftermath of the Cultural Revolution. And so on the 23rd of May 1967, Project 523 was initiated, which was a multicentric research initiative in China. Researchers as far apart as Beijing and Kunming, all told to work on anti-malarial drugs. Not just the existing synthetic drugs, which, by the way, considerable progress was made in modifying the known structures, but also the traditional pharmacopoeia. And cutting a long story short, out of that came this remarkable this rediscovery of a plant compound. This is a plant known as Artemisia annua, renamed Jinghao in Chinese. That's the, you'll immediately recognize the structure there as a sesquiterpene-lactone peroxide bridge over there. And that structure was thought to be impossible by biological chemists at the time, but turns out to be the most effective anti-malarial drug. There were several other drugs that came out of that which didn't make it, which are all good. That's the first reference in the medical literature you're probably familiar with. It's a relative of absinthe, and there were concerns over neurotoxicity, just as there is with absinthe, but actually those have not materialized. That's the plant, that's the structure. That's Mao Zedong discussing the biochemical structure with Ho Chi Minh. That's the original stuff. And it's remarkable, this paper, 5 pages, Chinese Medical Journal, 1979, describing everything. A brilliant new drug, a brilliant new discovery. Absolutely, you would have thought that everyone would have fallen over themselves to get hold of it. We did try and get hold of it, but there was, in fact, a long and painful process to get these drugs accepted by the West. They had remarkable activity. This is the only science slide. That's malaria parasites, young ones, old ones. These drugs kill the young ones before they become nasty and old. That's all I'll say. In Thailand, we were facing real problems with anti-malarial drugs. This is the cure rate of malaria, falciparum malaria. These are the years. This is chloroquine dying in the 1970s. This is the drug that followed chloroquine, sulfadoxin, pyrimethamine, dying in the early 1980s. This is the steady decline in quinine efficacy. Mefloquine was the new drug introduced in November 1984. It didn't last very long, resistance. And then by increasing the dose, you just delay the agony a little bit. But it did look as if we might be facing untreatable malaria, and we were saved by these drugs. Combining them with this dying drug. Now, when you're producing a combination treatment for anything, you'd rather have two things that work well rather than one that's dying and the good one. But that was all we had. And actually, it worked very well for a time. Meanwhile, in Africa, where most of the deaths occur, we think about 90% of the burden from malaria is in Africa. Mortality is rising from malaria, while deaths from other causes were falling. And the newly formed rollback malaria promise, which espoused the Abuja Declaration of reducing mortality by half by 2010, was seriously off course. And as I explained, the reason for that is that rotten drugs were being used, drugs which shouldn't have been used, which didn't work, and the insecticides were dying as well. And then some strange things happened. One of them was that malaria suddenly became fashionable. Now, it had always been a good buy economically. This was the disability-adjusted life years, and malaria is an extremely good buy in terms of health. But it also became popular. And you've got the most unlikely figures sharing the stage and singing or playing football or dancing for malaria. Everybody wanted to do something and help save the world from malaria. And then Bill and Melinda Gates joined. In fact, remarkably, in 2007, they introduced the concept again of elimination. Now, elimination had become a dirty word in malaria. The failure was seared deep in the heart of malariologists. Nobody would even talk about elimination. They said, actually, we believe elimination is possible. We will dedicate the not inconsiderable resources of our foundation. We know it's going to be a really long and painful job, but we've got to try and do it. So, funding starts to increase. Funding was very small initially, globally, but actually it started to increase. Everything was looking really good. WHO said, yes, maybe it could be done, but we need a few more tools. Scientists, of course, had always got the answers, and they just needed a little bit more funding to realize those answers. It was clear that genomics and proteomics were going to control malaria, and just on the verge of this brilliant vaccine drug, whatever it was, it was just around the corner. Just a small check from the Euston Road, that's all that would be needed. Everybody was going to make a vaccine. In fact, I don't know how many vaccine projects there are, at least 60, and everybody was funding them. Well, there's only one that's really got anywhere so far. I mean, there are some promising ones, but they're way back. And this is the RTSS, the sporozoite vaccine with a potent adjuvant. And as is often the case, in fact, invariably in malaria, the first results were very good. The next results were not quite so good. And the final results were not really good at all. But actually, although you might say that's not very good, even if you could get that, if you could get 36% protection, and we can argue about this afterwards, it might be worth having in the rather gloomy context I'm going to project to you a little bit later in this rather boring talk. So, what have we got? We've got three main tools. We've got insecticides. They do work in some circumstances. If you have a mosquito that lands on the wall of your house and you spray the house with insecticide, it works. If you have a mosquito that breeds in little crevices in the trees, spraying the wall of your house isn't going to, and bites you outside, then spraying the wall isn't going to do very good. Bed nets, they work. They work nearly everywhere except in Asia, where the mosquitoes, everything is tricky in Asia, and the mosquitoes are no exception, and they've figured out that it's best to bite people before they go near a bed net. Now, you can explain to an English policeman that that's not, the bed net's not going to work very well in that circumstance, but the donors still seem to think that's a good idea that they should be given. And after all, it is quite nice not to be bitten by other insects and things. But so, I'm being a little bit facetious. Insecticide treatment at bed nets have been a major, major advance in malaria, and they've been a major contributor to that 3 million lives saved. But they and they do work almost everywhere, and they should be given if they can be afforded, and they can be afforded, I believe. But there are some places where they don't work, and there are big concerns about resistance, and I'll bring those up a little bit later. But overall, overall, it's about a 20% reduction in all-cause mortality in malaria endemic areas of Africa by deploying bed nets. Drugs. I've talked about Jinghao Su. It's remarkable drugs. They save lives. They save lives in adults with severe malaria. They save lives if you give them to people, mainly children, near their home, because the delays in this lethal disease kill. And so if you can get these drugs into somebody before they start the potentially long journey to a hospital where they might get effective treatment, you will save lives. And in trials in Africa, again, they save lives. These are very large differences, and overall the sort of p-values that clinical trialists rather like. These are highly, highly effective drugs. They're the best drugs for treating severe malaria. They're the best drugs for treating uncomplicated malaria. They're used in combination with another anti-malarial drug because they're rapidly eliminated, and you need a slowly eliminated partner. And when they've been deployed, and as they were here in the epidemic of malaria in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, together with effective insecticide, then they're remarkably effective. But still, people didn't want to pay the money for people to have these drugs. And you got the sort of headlines in The Lancet you don't read very often. Many people, you know, most of us skim through the journals, but you tend to go back and have a look at that sort of a headline because that's rather an unusual one. And it's true. It's true that that this was a disgrace, that these drugs were available and they were not being deployed. But this incandescent headline and the paper that accompanied it, I think, were the tipping point. It was close before. A lot of people felt that it was absolutely essential these drugs should be used. International agencies were reluctant to pay for them. WHO, as ever, sat on the fence. And I think this is what did it, because very quickly we changed. The world changed, and they became used everywhere. And they became used in better ways, easier ways, fixed those combinations. So it was all looking pretty good. We started to have one of minor epidemic of action plans that occurred, and these said, carry on, chaps, do very well and make better things. So that was all very good. Meanwhile, everybody's involved, everybody's helping to save the world. There is a slight suspicion there might be too many people trying to save the world all at once, and there wasn't a very clear leader, and the organisation that should have been leading seemed to be more concerned with political rather than technical issues. Meanwhile, there were people who said, well, there are a lot of places with one or two cases of malaria, and we could shrink the map considerably by going to these places and getting rid of malaria. And there are loads of places, actually, where there's just a little bit of malaria. And many of these have actually eliminated in recent years. So there has been quite a lot of progress. But there are also difficulties. this is the heartland of malaria, this bit across the middle. And there's an awful lot of difficulty in doing things in these areas. There's a lot of conflict, as you are very well aware. Goodness knows what's going to happen in this part of the world where there's been extremely good control of malaria. Despite the Iraq war, erupted very well for malaria control. God knows what's going to happen now under the IS areas. I should imagine it'll come, but it's almost certainly been imported. So we know this is a perennial problem with any public health measures. There was no real thought about how to eliminate vivax, which is a difficult problem, a more tenacious problem, but I haven't got time to go into that. It requires a potentially poisonous drug. There's a lot of issues with quality of medicines in the tropics. For in many places, up to half the drugs available in the marketplace, and that, which is the main place where people get drugs, are either substandard or fake, frankly fake. These are all fake artesunate tablets. And it's not just one source of fakes. This is a forensic epidemiology investigation showing that there are at least two sources of fake artemisinins that were washing over Southeast Asia and clearly contributing to perceptions of drug failure and weakening health structures as people lost faith in medicines. Still a very, very big issue because it's not confined to Asia. We have fake medicines now increasingly recognized throughout Africa. And another thing happened, and that was the crash. So we'd been doing well with increasing... Cheza got malaria, that's all right, but she got better, that was okay. And then the same journal reported that a killer bug had been discovered. And yes, unfortunately, they were right. In the very same place where chloroquine resistance and sulfadoxin resistance had emerged, artemisinin resistance had now emerged on the western border of Cambodia. And the Lancet said, and I think they were reasonably right about this, that if full-blown resistance develops, there'll be nothing in the pipeline for 5 years, and that's still the case. So, again, plans, strategies. I'm not going to read these, but it's very difficult to divine from that list anything new. It just said carry on doing what you've been doing, really. The World Malaria Report of 2012, Margaret Chan starts to recognise this and says that it's absolutely essential to stop the spread of resistant parasites and an immediate comprehensive response is needed, combination of malaria control and elimination measures to stop the survival and spread of resistant parasites. Wasn't quite clear how that was going to be achieved, however. And as predicted, in combination drugs, as one partner fails, the other ones began to fail. And we started to see this amazing efficacy from combination treatments declining. The problem is that when you're relying on drugs to control malaria, and the insecticides or the bed nets don't do very well, you're fighting fire with fire. So as you reduce the number of patients, or cases or parasites, you're distilling down to the most resistant parasite. So, in a sense, the last man standing is the most resistant. And so the only way to deal with artemisinin resistance is to get rid of all the falciparum malaria. And you can only do that whilst the drugs retain efficacy, and we are losing the efficacy of these drugs. And the other problem is, and it's a slightly complicated one, but most of the people, even in areas of low transmission in the world, who carry malaria parasites are actually not ill. They've been ill in the past, and now they're walking around with low concentrations of parasites in the blood. And this is something we've really only become to realise in very recently, with the availability of very sensitive methods for detection. So, how do you get rid of malaria in people who are well? Because they don't come to the clinic complaining of being well. So, how do you get rid of malaria without treating everybody? New drugs. That's what everybody says will save us. But actually, it's not been a particularly good story. We thought with the full sequencing of the genomes that we would get new drugs. Well, it's been a remarkable story for HIV/AIDS, as you know. It's transformed the disease. HIV/AIDS is now just a chronic disease with a long life expectancy. It's been very difficult to develop new anti-malarial drugs. This is Jinghao Su, that's the rifamycins. There's not been a lot since. There's a few promising ones and a reasonable pipeline, but it's not quite clear if any of these are going to transform the situation. Here are some of them. Some of them look like Jinghao Su. Some of them are completely different. These are remarkable drugs, but they haven't even gone into the large trials, the phase 3 studies that you need, which will take at least 3 years. So we're not going to have these in the next 5 years. And the concern is that this resistance will do what it's done twice, not once, twice before, and that is spread across the world, just like chloroquine resistance did. And chloroquine resistance killed literally millions of children. That's not an exaggeration. The resistance to this drug killed millions of children. We really don't want that to happen again. And we know that resistance to the drug that followed chloroquine, sulfadoxine pyrimethamine, we know from the molecular signatures around this gene that those parasites also came from Southeast Asia. So twice before, resistance has spread from Southeast Asia to Africa. And the real concern is that this is all going to happen again. Well, initially, we hoped it would be confined to Western Cambodia. And so the comparator situation on the northern, this is the northwestern border of Thailand, we thought we were okay there, but actually we weren't. Resistance had been emerging under our noses and was clearly established. And indeed, the artemisinin combinations were starting to fail. So we attempted to find out how far this has spread, and I'll whiz through this fairly quickly. Bottom line is, it looked from the clinical trials as if resistance had got as far as the border with Myanmar, but we were doing very laborious trials to try and measure resistance, which were quite difficult to do. We needed an easy way to see how far this threat had spread. We needed a molecular marker. Now, these inevitably cause the final ptosis to go to encephalopathy. So those of you who are feeling relaxed, just keep staring at these dots. This is an attempt to try and find the molecular marker for artemisinin resistance, and there was certainly an association between the... There was something that was linked to artemisinin resistance on chromosome 13. Somebody else did a different study, and they found something on chromosome 13. So there are two flags now on chromosome 13. And our perspicacious colleagues in the Institut Pasteur went looking just between these two flags, and they found the molecular marker. Others went looking elsewhere and didn't find it. And that, so we now have a marker that identifies artemisinin resistance. And that's very useful, and we've used that in these various studies. I won't bore you with all this stuff, but effectively what they've shown is that resistance has spread further. Now, this isn't going to work. I know it's not going to work, and it's going to screw up the present. Okay, so I'm going to pass that by. And so that's all the past. And the next 30 seconds, I'll do the present and the future. So the major activity at the moment in dealing with this threat to global control of malaria, which could reverse all the gains that we've had in the last 15 years, the most important activity seems to be having meetings. And that there's been the most amazing proliferation of meetings and strategies. And books about strategies. Oh, no, that wasn't supposed to happen. Help. Why is it doing that? Go away. Right. So, in summary, current status, malaria is going down. It's going down quite a lot. These are the percentage change in malaria mortality rates. So we want to see it brown. Light brown, so things are going down well in most places. There are a few where there are increases, but the numbers in these areas are very small. This is where most of the mortality is, and it's going down. So far, so good. But the two tools, I talked too long about drug resistance. This is pyrethroid resistance. This is the insecticide those bed nets are coated with, and you can see that we have resistance, these red marks, really in Africa. But what's also notable is how few places are actually measuring it. In the place, this is the main malaria control tool. By comparison, this is pyrethroid resistance monitoring in a mite that affects honeybees. in the United Kingdom, which, by the way, is slightly larger than it should be. So you can see that the epidemiology of pyrethral resistance in bee mites is understood one hell of a lot better than pyrethroid resistance in malaria-carrying mosquitoes. We're losing the drugs in the Mekong area, and the last drug, the most recent one, which we thought was going to save us, dihydroartemisinin piperaquine, piperaquine, by the way, being another product of that ingenious Chinese research initiative, is also failing. Because it's like dominoes. One falls, the next falls, the next fall. And with this molecular marker, we've been able to map the spread of resistance and show that it's actually right on the border with India. And I can't believe it's not across. And it's not going to be easy to contain it, particularly in that northeastern part of India. As you know, access is poor in those areas. Getting anything done is difficult. So it may already be too late. We think that the only way you can get rid of this is to eliminate all falciparum malaria in the infected area, but that's becoming progressively less feasible. We think that we can improve control by doing belatedly following the lead of tuberculosis and HIV and using three drugs and not two. That's going to need a little bit of persuading for the malaria community, but that's the direction we're going in. That will buy us, or may buy us, some time. We're piloting mass drug administration. It's a horribly crude tool. You give everybody anti-malarial drugs. It's risky. It risks making the situation worse rather than better, but it's the only thing we think we can do. What about the future? Well, this is a very brief, I'm nearly the end now, so everybody can wake up at the back. It's not all bad news. I think you could say that there's an optimistic scenario, and that is that current control interventions will remain sufficiently effective. They're not clearly not very effective until the new drugs and insecticides are developed and deployed, and that a malaria vaccine, which would only be the RTSS vaccine, would contribute significantly to control and elimination, and that continuing strengthening of health systems and malaria control programs combined with a strong international and national, strong and honest leadership would drive malaria to elimination. Alternatively, there is the scenario that these drugs do not remain sufficiently effective, that the dominoes continue to fall rapidly, that the malaria vaccine is not cost effective and therefore not even registered, let alone subsidized. And deployed, and all these recent gains in malaria control and health and economic benefit are reversed. Artemisinin resistance spreads to Africa, if it hasn't already spread, in an itinerant Chinese worker working in a factory in Cambodia who gets on a plane and then goes to Burkina Faso or something like that, somebody like that. And artemisinin resistance emerges in Africa, making the drugs ineffective, and that the health systems and malaria control programs remain weak, and the international agencies remain ineffective. And with those cheery words, I'll stop. Thank you very much.